his words, he was an affable, unremarkable dad of three, a lucky man, not a glass half empty man at all. But then at the age of 40, he had a breakdown and the journey into depression and recovery. His story is underneath the lemon tree. He's Mark Rice-Oxley. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Bernie.
It sounds like there was no catalyst reading the book, no trigger.
I think there was no immediate trigger, but looking back, I'd been overexerting and just doing too much for a number of years. It's that very busy time in a new parent's life when young children, the demands of work and the pace of life just eventually overwhelmed me.
And work is journalism, and your psychiatrist said that your work, the field that you work in, meant that you set yourself unrelenting standards, which then would drive you harder to achieve.
Well, yeah, I think that's partly my response to it. I think any journalist will feel, will find this familiar, that it is an unrelenting business. It's exciting. It's 24/7, increasingly so. I just couldn't leave it alone, and I was working far too hard. And also then in my spare time, I'd be with my children. And in the end, I sort of forgot to think about myself.
There were signs. There are signs that kind of only make sense with hindsight. And wouldn't it be marvellous if God had given us that? Wouldn't it? Life would be so much simpler.
Absolutely.
You were moody, irritable, you had headaches, you worked long hours, you had shorter sleep.
Yeah.
It's only when you put that together that alarms start to ring, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, whilst those things were going on for me for several months, I was having those strange symptoms. I had no idea that there was something really badly going wrong. And it was, as you say, only with hindsight do I look back. I mean, to anybody out there who's listening, and if this is ringing any bells, I would say that sleep is one of the critical things. If you find yourself suddenly adopting completely different sleep patterns, waking up at 3 a.m, not able to get to sleep night after night, then something is your body trying to tell you something.
It's most peculiar because it does take people in different ways, and it's lethargy was the thing for you. And you think, well, if you're so tired, then you would be able to sleep. And it's a peculiar lethargy, really. It's an inability to engage with life, isn't it? There are times when I haven't felt miserable or melancholic or sad or anxious, but I've felt adrift from the rest of the world. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean. For me, it was very, very physical, heavy, leggy feeling. I remember one morning taking the kids to school, getting back and preparing to go to work and just lying on the bed and not really being able to move. It was so oppressive. But then that would pass, and then a different symptom would come in, like the insomnia or panic attacks and anxiety. Eventually, they all came all at once and completely overwhelmed me.
And bad thoughts fed themselves with you, did they?
Well, they did after the collapse, yeah. I think that it's fair to say that rumination and negative thoughts is an absolutely defining symptom of depression. We all do it. And actually, that can be a route to recovery when you realise that the bad thoughts you're thinking are not specific to you. They're specific to the illness, and everybody in the illness is having the same kind of negative thoughts. Once the penny drops on that, you can start to realise that you can beat this thing.
And how did the collapse manifest itself? What you call these baffling times. You couldn't read, no?
Yeah, I found it harder and harder to read, to concentrate, to enjoy anything. And it all came to a peak, actually, on my 40th birthday in London on a boat that we hired to go up and down the Thames. And I knew at that point I could barely face the crowd of partygoers. And
you said to your mum, it's heartbreaking, you said to your mum, stay with me.
Yeah, she was holding my hand, and it was like I felt like a little boy again. I couldn't sort of, you know, face my oldest and closest friends. And after that evening, we all knew suddenly something seriously wrong here, and we went back to the GP, and that's when the diagnosis came in. And that's when I sort of tumbled ashore on this sort of lonely catch-all illness they call depression, which for me was the sort of loneliest condition on the planet, even though tens of millions of people suffer from it.
And you went to the Priory. The Priory has been given almost mythical celebrity status. It's not glamorous, is it?
It's not at all. I mean, there was a tiny part of me that thought, ooh, the Priory, that's interesting.
I wonder who else.
Maybe I'll bump into someone famous. But actually, 99 thoughts out of 100 that day were just, I hope the psychiatrist, I hope he can give me some reassurance. I hope I can, you know, just get through this.
Celebrities use it because they have celebrity money. It's very expensive, isn't it?
It is expensive. It was eventually too expensive for me because, unfortunately, I didn't have the requisite health insurance. And that would be another message I would send out to listeners. Do check your health cover. Most of us would be covered if we run over by a bus, but you're far more likely to suffer from, you know, some kind of mental illness. And a lot of these health insurance policies no longer cover mental illness.
So how was the NHS set to help you?
The NHS is, I mean, it's a terrific organisation. Some fantastic people work in it, but it's simply not geared to deal with all the mental illness we have in our society today. My GP said to me, if the NHS provided all the psychiatric care that everybody who turned to it needed, it would be bankrupted six times over. So I got medication, and then I had to pay out of my own pocket to go and see a psychiatrist.
And it took you how long to start on the upward curve?
Looking back, I would say I was really unwell for 6 months. At the beginning of that period, there was no respite. Towards the end, there would start to be, you know, days and even weeks when I started to feel more like myself.
And what did it? Was it the medication?
It's really hard to say. People ask me this, but I tried 7 or 8 different things. So it's hard to say which one was pivotal. But I took the medication. I got into meditation and mindfulness, being gentle on myself, being far quieter in the days and weeks that I had. I was off work for 5 months. And that was I'm very grateful to my employer, The Guardian, for giving me that space that I needed. And love, family, friends, all those things helped. In the end, I think with a thing like this, you have to be curious. Why did it happen to you? Find out and cut out what it was that made you ill in the first place.
And you've done that, have you?
It's a work in progress. I try. For me, the thing that I look back and think, I was just, you know, burning the candle at both ends. I was overexerting. I'm someone who, I love living. I love being alive. I have a very full life, and it's hard to pull back and think, you know what, no, I'm not going to go to that party this evening.
And because you do love life, you never contemplated suicide?
I did, I absolutely did. But I would say at this point that this is, again, a defining feature of depression. It's a mind in meltdown. And I look back now with horror at the person that I was for those 6 months, because on several occasions I did think to myself, if this is how it's going to be for the rest of my life, I can't do it.
You know, I often wonder, Mark, how previous generations coped, because, and you'll have heard this phrase before, people say, in my day, people just got on with it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they did, or did they fall by the wayside, frowned upon when talking about their feelings?
Well, it's funny you should say that. My grandmother says exactly the same thing to me. She's 104. In my day, we didn't have depression, dear. Well, sorry, Gran, but you did. It was washed, it was hidden under the carpet. People were institutionalised. If you read any sort of literature or history from the 19th century or even the 20th century, you find that people are just hidden away. Then through the post-war period, they started to experiment more and more with medication and with electroconvulsive therapy, which is a pretty brutal way to treat the illness. And I think really only in the last couple of decades have we started talking about it more, trying to ask, what is it about the human condition that makes it vulnerable to such a spectacular sort of mental implosion?
Is that why you wrote the book, to help explain some of those taboos?
Absolutely. I mean, I originally wrote an article in The Guardian about 18 months ago, and the feedback was so positive and so overwhelming, and so many people wrote to me and said, thank you for articulating what I've been feeling. I've been able to show your article to my parents or to my partner, and they understand. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book, is help us understand what depression feels like from the inside out, why people get it, what you can do if you're in it, what you can try and do to recover, but most of all, why we need to be open about it.
And it is one of those things that is written about more now. It is isolating, but when you read other people's books, it's not quite, you know, today's topic of literature, because quite clearly there's Charles Dickens, but quite a few people deal with it. Marcus Truscothic has dealt with it in his book, Alan Bennett, M.F. Forrester wrote a very, very good book. Yeah. Sugar Ray Leonard, the same. A lot of people are affected, don't they?
There's a lot of people, there's a lot of this about, and it does make particularly good material to write about because it does feel so dramatic. I think that a lot of high performers and high achievers suffer because it sort of goes hand in glove with stress. And the first thing they want to do when they've had it is explain to the world, you know, what it feels like and how they got through it. I do think it's becoming more and more of the disease du jour. You know, the World Health Organization says this will be second only to HIV/AIDS in the toll that it exacts on our society by the end of this decade. And so I just think it's becoming a real, more and more of a talking point.
Well, I've read it, and it's oddly an uplifting book. It's a memoir of depression and recovery, and you immediately think, oh, not many laughs. But it is a deeply enlightening book. It's called Underneath the Lemon Tree. It's published by Little Brown at $13.99 by Mark Rice Oxley. And the in-laws are here in Kingsthorpe, are they not, Mark?
That's right, yeah. I've been to Northampton on lots because my wife is from there, and my in-laws will probably be listening to this. And they were a great help to me through my illness, and a great help to my wife.
So their names, you should give them a shout, because it never helps. You know, you can't help it, but if you suck up, can you? It's going to do you some good.
Well, Pauline Matthews will probably be at home listening to this. Sid Matthews might be out on the golf course, but if he's not, hi Sid, hi Pauline.
Thanks, Mark, very
much. Thanks, Bernie. Cheers.